You're listening to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. I'm Megan Wild. This episode is one of my favorites since I started producing this show a year and a half ago. So brace yourselves for an interesting, inspiring conversation about housing, climate, generational fairness, and much more.
That money that is sort of building up in the walls of our houses is in some senses being taken out of the pockets of young people. And that's not fair.
My co-host, Paul Kershaw, spoke with Max Fawcett, the lead columnist for Canada's National Observer and host of the Observer podcast, Maxed Out. Enjoy.
I am absolutely delighted to be welcoming Max Fawcett to our Hard Truth podcast, because Max is just one of those columnists in Canada I read regularly. And so thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me on, Paul. You're one of my favorite people in this space, someone who says the things that aren't always popular, but need to be said. So I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Well, great. You know, we have this now mutual admiration society we just signaled in part because from my perspective, you're one of the few columnists in Canada who routinely brings to your analyses an intergenerational lens. And so I want to know, Max, how'd you come to, you know, develop these intergenerational glasses? Where'd that come from?
To some extent, they were handed down by my parents. They are both social democrats, involved in politics, involved in injustice issues, and they kind of taught me the importance of seeing the bigger picture on these sorts of things. It also is a product, I guess, of failure, for lack of a better term. When I was in my 20s and I was trying to sort of slingshot myself into a columnist gig at the Globe and Mail, I wrote a book, or I pitched a book, I should say, where I metaphorically put the baby boomers on trial for their various crimes. And not surprisingly, it didn't get through to publication, in part because I wasn't a particularly great writer back then, but also because my editor and my publisher were both baby boomers. I don't think they relished the idea of having their generation put on trial. So, you know, I think that exposed me to the cleavages, the injustices that are formed around generational experiences in Canada. And it kind of just made me very attuned to, in spite of the fact that we have a lot of progress that we can be very proud of over the last few decades, when it comes to some very material basic things, housing, shelter, it's much harder in a lot of respects for young people than it's ever been. And I had hoped that it would get better as I got older. Instead, it just keeps getting worse. And, you know, I think it demands more conversation.
Given that I think you're a rare bird by bringing the intergenerational lens to your work, you know, why do you think there aren't more journalists out there for whom that's a primary focus or perspective from which they write?
It's funny. I think you find, if you get young journalists around a table in a place like Vancouver or a place like Toronto, which is where they, you know, tend to congregate, this conversation can happen pretty naturally. I think everyone is aware of the ways in which things are different now than they were, you know, a couple generations ago. And I think most of us have had well-meaning parents suggest rather blithely, like, oh, you should just buy a house. It's what I did. And you know, I ended up quintupling my money. I've had many conversations where we vent and share frustrations about that. But it's one of those issues where you almost age out of it when you have kids, when you buy a house. I think for a lot of people, they kind of put that behind them because they're in a different group all of a sudden. You know, I bought a house a couple of years ago with my wife, and it's gone up in value far more than we have any right to expect. And I think a lot of people, when that happens, it kind of shifts their perspective, where suddenly they're no longer sort of outside the problem, they're sort of inside the problem, right? And so they have less motivation to solve the problem because solving the problem might cost them money. I guess I'm wired a little differently in that respect, where if someone told me that we could push a button and make house prices go down 30%, I mean, we'd be in the red personally, but I wouldn't care. It would be the right thing to do. It would be the good thing to do. And I would want to see it happen. So, you know, I think that is why you see less attention to this issue than maybe we should, is because, you know, like I said, a lot of people just naturally age out of it and move on to other things.
Well, then I suspect it's that analysis that motivates one of your recent columns. And here I'm going to quote you to you. The beating heart of any successful housing strategy in this country involves going after the biggest enemy in all of this, our own behavior. I wonder if you can expand upon that for me. Tell me what you're getting at. I'll confess, you know, it got me out of my chair. I was like, preach to me, Brother Fawcett. So share more with our listeners what you had in mind there.
I mean, The problem is that in this country, as in most countries, you know, that the percentage of homeowners is somewhere between 65 and 70%. I guess it's a little less in some European countries, but it's a clear majority of people who have a vested interest in the price of housing not going down. Some of us understand, well, if it goes down, then, you know, maybe I could move up the property ladder, yada, yada, yada. But by and large, our sort of selfish gene kicks in when we talk about this issue. And so I think it's very tempting to think that, you know, we can find this like one external source that would solve the problem. You know, if we just tax foreign investment enough, if we just tax real estate investment trusts enough, if we target this certain group of others, then we will solve this problem. And I'm not saying that those aren't part of the solution, but I think we've seen this, you know, in Vancouver, where we've had foreign buyers taxes, we've had vacancy taxes, and it's not really moving the needle to the extent that it needs to. The real issue, the real sort of center of this conversation, is all of us that own homes, that financially benefit from the ownership of homes. And until we're willing to have that conversation around reorienting our worldview of how we progress and how we build wealth and make it not just about homes, I don't think we're going to get to the place that we need to be. You know, and this has all sorts of knock-on effects, as we all know, in terms of young people not being able to start businesses, start families, less risk-taking in Canada. Like, there's all sorts of negative outcomes that flow from our obsession with housing and our refusal to kind of do anything about it. But until we look in the mirror and really understand that we're part of the problem, I don't think we're going to get to a place where we find the solution.
So you're definitely one of the few people I've ever heard say that aloud, other than those of us at Gen Squeeze, to be honest. I mean, the language that we often use is like, there's been this tendency to try and go after the easy villain. And you just labeled them, you know, the foreign buyer, the speculator, the person with the empty home, the mean-spirited developer, the NIMBY, you know, the inefficient not-for-profit. And as you just identified, they're all others. It's always somebody else who's the problem. And in Gen Squeeze, we talk about this cultural addiction to high and rising home prices, and that we need to break the addiction and see how we are all, or at least so many of us, entangled in it, whether intentionally or otherwise, making decisions that reinforce the housing status quo. But one thing that you're making me consider about myself is I've often been less bold than your language is in terms of what we want for home prices. As we've tried to break Canada's addiction to high and rising home prices, the language that we've used is like to restore affordability for all. We minimally need home prices to stall so that earnings can catch up. And the selection of the word stall but not fall is definitely a tactical choice. And so I wondered, what do you think about that tactical choice, Max?
I understand it. I'm not sure that we have the appetite in this country for a really honest conversation about what it's going to take. But I try to imagine it from the perspective of someone who's in their mid-20s, you know, out of university, maybe has a little bit of debt, but they're in that phase where their career is going. They want to start saving. They want to make a move. And if we just stall home prices, that doesn't help them, right? It would take them three lifetimes for their earnings to catch up to the point where they would be able to do what their parents did and you know, put a down payment on a reasonable house in a reasonable neighborhood. You know, I think their situation demands more drastic action. And I, you know, it used to be that it was this thing that only happened in certain parts of Vancouver and Toronto, right? And the rest of the country was still fairly reasonable, fairly affordable. You know, well, maybe you can't get a house in Kitsilano anymore, but you can still get one in Calgary, or you could get one in Guelph, or wherever. And over the last few years, we've seen that that's no longer true in any of those places. All those places are now certainly not as expensive as Vancouver or Toronto, but they are as ludicrously overpriced relative to their historical norms. So the issue is becoming more national. It is affecting more people. And I do wonder if at some point, we're going to be willing to have that braver conversation. But, you know, the real impediment in a lot of this is our elected officials. And look, I blame them a little bit. I'm not going to say I don't blame them, but I understand why they are so scared of this issue. Politicians, I think by their nature, are a little bit cowardly, but, you know, on this issue, they're downright petrified and with probable good reason. But at some point, someone's going to have to take that risk. You know, the thing that worries me is, you know, I've had this conversation with folks, you know, I say politicians need to take some risks here. And a few people here in Alberta go, well, what about Jim Prentice? because Jim Prentice in 2015, you know, for those who don't live here, the TLDR version is we don't pay enough in taxes and we get the most, we spend a lot on social programs. We spend less in recent years, but traditionally, even under the conservative governments, we've spent a lot because Albertans want to have their cake and eat it too. And he told Alberta voters in 2015, we need to look in the mirror, right? Essentially saying it's not the NDP's fault. It's not the conservatives' fault. It's kind of all of our faults for expecting to have gold-plated public services and not pay anything, you know, or pay as little as possible in taxes. And he got drummed out of office for that. You know, the conservatives lost their first election in 40 years. And so I don't see any good examples out there in the political landscape right now of a politician saying something brave and courageous, genuinely brave and courageous, and being rewarded for it. And I think until we do see that, it's going to be harder for the other ones to fall in line that way.
Well, I hope then that a group like Jen Squeeze can actually turn that around. We've done some polling that does show that 69% of Canadians affirm the idea that to restore affordability for all, we need home prices to stall. And just this past week, for the first time, I believe it's for the first time ever, we had not only a senior political leader, but our prime minister say in response to a question from, in this case, it was a reporter from Global News. And the answer was, we can't have home prices continue to go up. We can't keep wanting that. So, you know, that then behooves groups like Jen Squeeze to figure out how can we create enough political cover for not only the prime minister, but all political leaders to start standing courageously in, you know, in support of that view. But you're right. Like, it's up to us as citizens to make that politically safe. And I really like the way that you're just talking about this. There's so much cynicism about politics. And we're often like angry with our politicians, but we often get the politics we deserve because we don't create the political cover for our politicians to be more brave.
It was a big deal that the prime minister said out loud the thing that anyone who pays attention to this file knows, which is that house prices can't continue to go up. What we now need someone to say is house prices have to go down. Right. And I don't think he's there yet. I you know, I'm very sure that Pierre Poilievre is not there yet. I'm glad that we suddenly have this intense focus on housing issues. I think it's, you know, 5 or 6 years too late, but better late than never. But those of us who sort of are invested in this issue and want to see progress have to kind of use the moment to really kind of advance the conversation in ways that we maybe couldn't have without the sort of sense of urgency that's out there right now.
Yeah. Well, I know that politicians worry about this kind of issue because more generally they think that it risks creating tensions between generations. Like, you know, housing is a quintessential intergenerational tension, and an older demographic, as you've already said, is the winners from high and rising home prices, their kids and grandchildren losing out. When we try and tackle issues like that, or, you know, climate change or some of the challenges in fiscal policy or underinvestments in young people or running deficits when we're not in recession, you know, the kryptonite that we face as an organization is that we can be seen as pitting generations against one another. You're not an organization that's trying to move evidence into action. You're a reporter. You don't have to be a diplomat. But do you ever worry that you're perceived as sowing division between generations?
I mean, I'm the guy who pitched a book, tried to put the baby boomers on trial. So, I would say I've gotten more worried about that with the passage of time. You know, whenever I've talked about this with baby boomers who point out that, you know, well, I'm not the problem. I didn't do this, blah, blah, blah. I say, look, it's not about you. It's about this generational concept, this amalgamation of yous and the situation and conditions that you lucked into. It's, you know, we're not saying that you maliciously did this. We're simply saying that it happened and we have to address the consequences. But my sense now is, you know, there are enough boomers who get that this is affecting them, whether it's sort of indirectly through their kids not living near them, or they just, you know, they don't put their own economic self-interest at the front of everything. You have enough allies there that I don't really think you need to spend too much time trying to win them over. I think, especially as Gen X and the millennials become more powerful politically, you know, we've seen in recent elections, they're a bigger and bigger part of the voter base. They're a bigger and bigger part of deciding the outcomes. My advice would be simply to bet on them, to bet on their anger, to bet on their frustration, and not use it to stoke division. You know, my argument is always, you know, against the conditions, not against the people, notwithstanding the book we've discussed. But, you know, if you worry too much about hurting people's feelings, it's often hard to say the things you really need to say out loud. right? Maybe we need to hurt some people's feelings a little bit on this stuff. Maybe that'll be what breaks through their indifference or their inability to understand just how bad things are for young people right now, because it is a crisis. And you only get to be in your 20s and 30s once. You don't get that time back. And if you spend it in housing stress, housing crisis, it really takes away something that in some respects, everyone should have the right to have. So I would argue for, and this is probably just in my nature, a more confrontational approach, but a confrontation with, you know, not so much their privilege or their wealth, but the things that they got to enjoy that their kids and grandkids probably aren't or won't, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's how you get at it.
Well, you're really invoking a dialogue that's happened on the Gen Squeeze podcast since its inception, where one of our hosts, Angie Chan, often talks about this theme of love between generations, kind of like harnessing that. And then we've got feedback from some folks like, hell, you're too nice. Like, take the gloves off. And you seem to be more in the take the gloves off category. I try and go back and forth. I don't think we can solve this problem without intergenerational solidarity in the world of politics. But I do know we need to share hard truth, hence the name of the podcast. And it's not about what individual boomers did, you know, because many of them and their families, they were great caregivers and parents and grandparents and so on. It's just that as beyond their family, as citizens on their watch, and that's the phrase I find myself using more and more, on their watch, policies that failed to carefully steward collective resources on which their generation and following generations were going to need to depend were accepted and sustained. And so there was a duty, a responsibility. When you come before, you're kind of an authority to either be good stewards or not. And I think that's the generational charge that we're wanting to put forward to people, that it may not have been intentional, but it still happened on their watch. What do you make of that phrase? And how might you, with your journalistic savvy, help me flesh that out to communicate it more effectively?
I wish that appeals to solidarity were more effective than I think they are. I mean, this is just my bias, my cynicism as a, you know, I guess as a liberal, but I think people are very captive to their self-interest. And so on some level, you have to speak to that self-interest. It can be enlightened self-interest. It can be motivated self-interest. But I think you have to do more than appeal to their sort of responsibilities to the collective, because I don't think a lot of, especially, you know, don't get me started about boomers, but especially that generation, I don't actually think they have a strong sense of their responsibility to the collective. You know, one of the defining aspects of the culture that they surrounded themselves with was kind of a me first, self-actualized way of living. And so, you know, I think a better way to frame it for them would be, you don't want your legacy to be that you left the next generations in an impossible situation. You still have time to do the right thing here and be viewed through the lens of history as a generation that did good things. I think they're sensitive to that. I think that is an argument that resonates with a lot of them, because they do want to be seen to do the right thing. I think they feel like they did the right things, and they certainly don't like it when you point out that their actions have sometimes fallen short of their words. But, you know, I think that's a more profitable avenue of pursuit than essentially trying to like guilt them into doing the right thing here, because I don't think they're particularly guilty in how they view themselves.
That's fascinating. Well, I want to push our intergenerational conversation to be more than just housing. And so I'm curious about your reflections on the way that Mr. Polyev's Axe the Tax has really been gaining momentum. I ask you that in no small part because you bring a vantage from Alberta. A lot of your commentary is about Alberta. This narrative has got Alberta voters absolutely in mind. What's your take on this issue from an intergenerational perspective, you know, because it is putting at serious risk our pricing pollution legislation?
You know, I have tried to make the argument with people who are skeptical about climate policy, you know, especially conservatives, tried to make the argument that they have a duty of care to the future. You know, they love to talk about how deficit spending is endangering future generations, but seem to not be able to connect the dots on things like climate change and what that does. And you know, to be honest, it isn't that successful. And I think part of it is that we assume that human beings are rational in how they, and I'm going to slip into like econ talk here, but how they sort of discount the future, right? We assume that human beings are reasonably rational in saying like, well, I don't want to do something that's going to cost me 10x in 10 years if it gives me 1x today. But I've found, just especially in the climate stuff, but in the housing stuff as well, we assign almost no value to future outcomes. It is all near-term oriented. Our behavior, our values, we're either very optimistic about the future or we're just very indifferent to it. And so I think arguments that try to appeal to what might happen in 2050 are just pushing up against the way we're wired as people. We just don't assign the right amount of value to those things. And so, you know, I think the liberals have done a just appallingly bad job from start to finish in branding and communicating their carbon tax. You know, they haven't told people about the rebates. They haven't done a good job of making it clear who the rebates come from, when they arrive, in what form they arrive. You know, you still have a large percentage of the population that doesn't know that the rebates exist, right? And we're 4 years in now to this program being in existence. So it has just been a mess in terms of the communications around it. And I think Polyev's approach is incredibly cynical. I think it's incredibly short-sighted. I think it will do all sorts of longer-term economic damage to the country, as well as damage in terms of our ability to respond to climate issues and the severity of them. But I don't think voters care, or I certainly don't think enough voters care. And so I think if you're making a climate argument in the next election, you need to make sure that you're making it in the time frame that people actually pay attention and add value to things, you know, the next 5 years, not the next 25.
Yeah, I find that really compelling. We're often saying, like, look, we can't solve our wallet problems by neglecting our climate problems. But I don't mean that in terms of, like, you know, our climate problems are 2050. I mean that this summer, the country from coast to coast to coast was on fire. At other times, it's underwater. Other times, you know, we're suffering drought and can't grow things or don't have, you know, drinking water. This isn't a tomorrow thing. This is a thing now. It's an intergenerational injustice because it is creating for anyone in their, you know, 40s, 30s, 20s, those kids who are going to be born into the future, it's creating for them just an entire lifetime of having extreme weather put at risk their economy and literally the determinants of health. Help me think through what it looks like to say, look, we can help your wallet problems by getting better housing affordability, by making childcare more affordable, by addressing post-secondary debt, by thinking about the healthy retirement that our aging population needs. We do those things to solve our wallet problems, and then that positions us better to deal with the costs of fighting extreme weather now.
Yeah, I think there was an interesting poll that came out recently from it's a new group, sort of affiliated with the federal government climate apparatus, and they did polling on the Greenbelt. And essentially, the findings were, especially young people, but even the broader population, don't want housing solutions that come at the cost of our climate goals. So people don't see those two things as oppositional. I think there's an opportunity to really marry those two things and say, look, we need to build a ton more housing right now, but we also can build that housing in ways that is good for the environment, that doesn't contribute to sprawl, that uses, you know, the right materials, that are energy efficient. Like, there's a good opportunity there. You know, as to the sort of broader climate issue, I've been actively involved in this space since 2017 when I went to work for the Alberta Climate Change Office. And my advice has always been, and it remains probably even more strongly today than ever, that you need to explain this to people through the prism of their own self-interest. And I know I'm starting to sound a bit repetitive here, but I really believe that. And so saying it's a good thing to do this because it will save a species down the road, or it will make life better for people in 2100, nobody cares. There are people who care and they're good people, but by and large, the public doesn't care. But if you say to them, hey, if we install this energy efficient retrofit to your house, you know, new windows, or we put solar panels on your roof, it's going to save you money. Right? That resonates much more quickly with people, and you get them where you need them to be without needing them to carry all the things that you know and believe about climate change. Former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, was at a conference recently. I think it was a conference of progressives, and she was one of the speakers. And that's sort of what she said. She said, look, I don't need people who drive EVs to believe everything that I know to be true about climate science. I just need them to drive EVs. And if it takes them being excited about how fast they accelerate or how much they can save on gas to get them to sign their name on the dotted line, that's all we need to do, right? And I say this with all the love in my heart for economists. They're my favorite academic discipline in the world. But we got to stop listening to them quite so much on this issue. You know, the carbon tax was designed to please that demographic. And it does please them. They love it. It's the most efficient way to reduce emissions. You know, conservative economists tend to like it, even though they don't actually vote in a way that reflects that, but they like it. You know, it satisfies the sort of economic modelers out there. But politically, it's a disaster because every time you go to the gas station, you're reminded that you're paying more because of this policy, right? That doesn't happen if your policy is investing in industrial subsidies like the US or things that deliver emissions reductions, but don't remind people every time they have to fill up their car that they're the ones paying for it. I think we should have thought a little harder about political durability and a little less hard about economic efficiency. You know, efficiency is great, but it's not efficient if the policy gets repealed every 6 years, right? That's actually very inefficient to have to constantly be going back to the drawing board and either shift the policy mix or reorient it completely. So I'm not sure that the Liberals have time or the inclination to kind of switch gears on this, but I do think that's been one of the lessons of the last few years is efficiency is not necessarily the name of the game.
That's an interesting potential indictment of Jen's squeeze strategy. I'm in that camp, an ardent supporter of the price on pollution, both for its efficiency purposes, but also just as like, if you make the mess, frigging well, pay for it. That's what pollution is. It's a mess that we're leaving for others. That's now incredibly harmful, whether it's like compromising our ability to breathe or eat or drink. And so I like it. You know, I want our country to be the kind of place that says, yeah, I'm willing to pay for my pollution. But I take your points about its political saleability. So I'm going to percolate more, maybe pivoting strategy in light of the Max Fawcett critique about be a political realist, Paul. Speaking of political realism, I would like to touch on a emerging theme from Alberta politics, which is going to be with us, regretfully, for the coming year or so, because, you know, you really are building a conversation about an Alberta-only pension plan. And you're going to want to, you know, according to your premier, take more than 50% of all the assets from the Canada Pension Plan and allocate that to your not even 12% of Canadians who reside in Alberta. Tell me a little bit more about what the heck is going on with this kind of conversation? Because the CPP, in our view at Gen Squeeze, is like one of the most intergenerationally sound public policies we have. And even that is being sort of ripped at by your premier.
Yeah, it's, I don't know how else to put it except to say that it's nuts. We knew this report was coming. We knew that this is an idea that conservatives in Alberta have fawned over for, you know, well over 20 years now since the firewall letter. Nobody expected that they were going to come out with this number that Alberta is entitled to more than half of the total assets of the Canada Pension Plan. Talking to economists about it, it's nonsense, and it will be treated as nonsense by the federal government. There's no, I can't even begin to get into how gerrymandered the analysis is that arrives at that. If you take the math that they use for Alberta and also apply it to Ontario and BC, the amount of money that all three provinces would be due is 128% of the CPP's total value. So obviously it's nonsense, right? But if they choose to move forward with it in a referendum and ultimately with legislation, there will be lawsuits. It will be in the ether for the next 10 years. It's a very cynical, but I think effective way of reframing what the Canada Pension Plan is by suggesting that, you know, it's like Albertans as a whole are contributing to it rather than just me as an individual citizen, regardless of where I live. You know, I've lived in BC, I've lived in Ontario, I live here now. It's not like my contributions only happen in Alberta, but they've sort of framed it as Alberta is subsidizing the rest of Canada and they're tired of subsidizing the rest of Canada. You know, that is disappointing on so many different levels. I think the good news here is that this is short of a politician coming out and saying they want to make capital gains taxable on people's principal residences. This is probably the most unsaleable idea I've ever come across. It might do okay in Alberta in the referendum simply because the numbers that the government is throwing out are so ludicrously high and the PR campaign they're rolling out is going to be so aggressive. They might bully a bunch of people into believing that they can get themselves a unicorn out of all this. But the federal government is ultimately the one that gets to decide how much money Alberta repatriates if it leaves the Canada Pension Plan. And I don't care if you're Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, you're Prime Minister Pierre Poilievre, you're Prime Minister Maxime Bernier, you're not going to agree to this because it would be suicide in the rest of the country, especially Ontario, especially BC. So, you know, I've just finished a call and my argument is that very inadvertently, and I'm sure not at all on purpose, Danielle Smith may have thrown Justin Trudeau a lifeline here.
Yeah.
Because now he gets to sort of put on his cape and be Captain Canada and defend the Canada pension plan against these Albertans who want to take more than half of it. And the CPP is, I don't think there's a more popular program in Canada. It is untouchable. And it is the gold standard for pension plans globally. You know, it is better than almost any pension plan on earth. Why we would want to jeopardize that is just kind of beyond me. But, you know, there are a couple of theories. One of the theories is that the financial sector in Alberta sees the amount of money and they want to get their hands on it. And guess what? They just happen to be big donors to the UCP. The other theory, which was floated by Jack Mintz, who's a conservative columnist and a guy the UCP always goes to when they want to pay someone to do a panel, he had a column saying that, well, this is really just about backing the feds off from their climate change policies, you know, to basically to threaten them so they won't move forward with the emissions cap for oil sands companies, or they won't move forward with other things. That would be political suicide too. If you are a conservative politician and you are trying to blackmail Canadians with their own pension plan to slow roll climate policy, I mean, I don't even think the Liberals could screw that one up. It is such a gift to them politically. So we'll see how this all plays out. I mean, if I was advising conservatives, and that will never happen, but I would tell them to put this in their back pocket and leave it alone because it's going to blow up in their face. But they have been enamored of this for so long. And I know there are people within their political community who see the energy transition coming, who see the impact that's going to have on access to capital for oil and gas companies, and are saying, look, maybe that $300 billion would come in real handy in a few years. I'm not sure they can resist that. And so, you know, if this happens, we're going to have a battle the likes of which we haven't seen since the 1980s and early 1990s in this country.
Well, that's fascinating. I was going to ask, are you going to write about it, Max? But you already told me you are. That's not surprising. And so as we wind down, let me bring it back to the housing theme. At Gen Squeeze, we have this routine saying, you know, you can wind me up. I'm a little like a little monkey doll. You wind up and I could just say the sayings over and over again. So one of the sayings is there's no silver bullet to solve the housing affordability crisis. There is silver buckshot. And we go through the flavors of the month about what the silver bullet is and that people are excited about. We've talked about some back in the day with sort of foreign buyers. And really recently we had a flavor of the month that it was like these terrible foreign students who are coming and screwing up our housing system. But the really emerging dominant silver bullet of the day is sort of supply. And we just need more supply. It's kind of a blunt supply analysis. Supply is obviously really critical. But I was taken with some of your recent writing, especially I think you were kind of engaging with a provocative video by Mr. Polyev where he's like, build, build, build. So can you share a little bit more with our listeners as we wind down what your take on the supply theme is and let us know why you think it's not a silver bullet? And as you do think about, like, how do you help us all become better salespeople for silver buckshot and not just silver bullets?
It's hard because it's much more tempting to want to find a silver bullet because it's easy. It's not a lot of work, right? It's one shot. And the truth of this issue is that it's going to be hard work. It's going to be a lot of small, grinding sort of conversations, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of difficult things, and we're going to have to get there together. I think the supply issue, in a way, touches on the whole selfishness thing that I was talking about earlier. You know, a lot of the supply issues in this country are not because of gatekeepers, quote unquote. It's because of elected officials responding to the expressed selfishness of single-family homeowners, of people saying, I don't want to live next to a duplex. I don't want to live next to a small apartment building. Put it somewhere else. It's not my problem. And those little decisions at the municipal level have just combined and combined and combined to feed this crisis. Nobody wants the solution to the problem to impact what they look at when they walk out their front door. And we have to dispense with that privilege, that luxury, if we're ever going to get anywhere on this. You know, you cannot have entire swaths of major cities like Vancouver and Toronto and Calgary zoned for just single family residences. It's not realistic. You know, I remember reading, this was a neighborhood that I was a renter in about a decade or so ago. It has fewer people living in it today than it did in 1970, right? Because it has become sort of enthralled to the people who own houses there, and they simply refuse to allow any new people to move into the neighborhood. And so there's like the odd apartment building, and it's a sort of more hollowed out neighborhood today as a result. So it really is kind of a pitched battle within your own community with wherever you live in this country to say, look, the way we've lived and the way we've done things is not going to work anymore. It's just not working. It's not adding up. And we need to kind of throw everything on the table and be willing to have a little bit of discomfort. You know, maybe you don't want something built in your neighborhood a certain way, but guess what? You're part of a community that extends beyond your front lawn, if you're lucky enough to have one. And that's a conversation that I think young people can have with their parents and grandparents and whatnot and say, look, like, I understand that this is the way you think people should live, and this is sort of the platonic ideal, but we need a new platonic ideal if we're going to make this country accessible to young people again, to immigrants, to strivers, to entrepreneurs, to people who want to do more than just spend 60% of their income on housing. You know, shelter should not be the thing that, you know, defines how we exist and the choices we make. But for a lot of people, like, they don't have any other choice but to let it have that defining influence. I'd love to get back to a place where we didn't talk about housing like it was some sort of national obsession. But it's going to require some hard conversations, and it's going to require electing people who are willing to kind of stick their necks out a little further than we've seen so far. And I don't know where that begins and when it starts, but the next election would probably be a good place for that to happen.
Well, you know, Max, I think you just really demonstrated to our listeners the intellectual flexibility and credibility you bring to your writing, because you just gave a really impassioned defense of why additional supply matters. And in some of your recent columns, though, you've given an impassioned critique about why a simplistic take on just adding more supply is actually a distraction from so many other important solutions. And, you know, I applaud that ability to do both.
Well, and I appreciate that. Let me just circle back really quickly, because I didn't talk about just simple supply measures being the solution. Again, that's just another silver bullet, right? It's just another thing that happens to other people that I can support, and it doesn't impact me. And those aren't good enough. If there's going to be a meaningful response to this issue that makes housing affordable, it's going to affect all of us probably a little bit negatively. And that's okay, because it's been affecting those of us who own homes very disproportionately in the positive sense. And that comes at a cost. It's not like that just sort of falls out of the sky. That money that is sort of building up in the walls of our houses is in some senses being taken out of the pockets of young people. And that's not fair. So, you know, I grew up in a co-op in Vancouver. I think we should be massively reinvesting in that sort of approach. You know, it's not good enough just to throw supply at the wall. It needs to be the right kind of supply. And it needs to be supply that is not necessarily tethered to the market, right? We need a lot of supply that, for example, gives seniors the ability to move into a smaller space so they can sell their homes, and maybe that home can be developed into four homes. You know, it's all part of this continuum and this chain of choices, but we have to start making the right choices in our own lives and with our own sort of self-interest so they can start to snowball in the right direction.
Well, Max, I thought that was going to be my last question, but I'm going to push our time and our listeners to stay with us for one more. On multiple occasions today, you've talked about why political tactics ought to appeal to persons' inherent self-interest. But you started our conversation today and just, you know, alluded to it as we're wrapping up about how you're a homeowner. And you mentioned at the top, imagine that home prices went down 30%. I think you said, you know, we'd be underwater. And yet you added, and yet I still think that would be a good thing to happen. You seem to be modeling something very different. And I think there's an interesting tension there. And I want to know why.
I mean, part of it is, you know, I circle back to my parents. They taught me that the whole point of life is not to kind of accumulate the largest amount of assets. It's to help the largest number of people. And so I try to see things through that prism. I fail sometimes. But the other part of it is that it kind of isn't against my self-interest, because I'm at the point in my life with, you know, my wife, God bless her. She's a fantastic professional and does really well. If home prices fell 30%, we could move up the property ladder. We could get a bigger house. We could get a bigger backyard. And so I'm not convinced that we have to sort of abandon the self-interest argument even there among young people. I think there's sort of like an interesting opportunity for the federal government to maybe protect people in that early stage of home ownership, so a big market correction doesn't put them on their butts in terms of not being able to pay their mortgage. But part of it is just reconstructing what self-interest means and how we look at it, right? You can use self-interest as a lens to look at things in a lot of different ways. And I think maybe on housing, we've been looking at it a little too simplistically. And if we can kind of reorient that into a bit of a bigger picture view, you know, maybe that helps.
Well, Max Fawcett, I haven't left the conversation feeling this inspired for a while. If we could replicate your thinking from coast to coast to coast, we truly could make this country work for all generations. I just want to thank you so much for your leadership in shaping public dialogue through your column at the National Observer. I want to thank you for your time here, you know, educating me and our listeners And I wish you so much success going forward, because I think your success is going to be our community success, our country's success.
You are being way too kind, but I will not say no to it. I guess I would simply say the same thing to you, that, you know, your organization is one of the few out there that actually takes this thing on in an honest way and does move the conversation forward. And so hopefully, you know, over the next couple of years, we can take what we've done over the last decade and move it forward five times that much. And maybe it's time for organizations to start nominating and running candidates. And believe me, I'm not suggesting me, I would be the worst political candidate in the world, but finding young people who can speak to this articulately and try to create some of those proof points out there that we can elect people who can tell the truth about this and it doesn't cost them, right? Hmm. Courage can be contagious.
Courage can be contagious. Let's end it there. Thank you so much, Max Fawcett.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks so much for joining us on Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. You can learn more about Generation Squeeze at gensqueeze.ca. Thanks for listening.